It's the Richie Allen Show, live from Salford with me, the BBG, Richie Allen.
Uncensored, unfiltered, you're listening to Richie Allen on the world's most popular independent news radio show.
Right, that is Bruce Springsteen waiting on a sunny day, 26 minutes past the hour, Monday's programme. I can't tell you anything. You don't know about Tony Gosling, author, broadcaster, and not at the BCFM Politics Show, 5 o'clock Fridays out of Bristol. It's terrific. And of course, former BBC journalist, welcome back, T. Good to have you on. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
You sound good. You sound like you're in the next room. It's gorgeous. It's the technology. Great to have you back. Before we talk about the lunacy unfolding in Shanghai, or excuse me, in Beijing, on the foot of Shanghai, and why we might be nervous about that, because I am, I'd like to kick off talking a little bit about, why not, just for 2 minutes, because it's everywhere today. This talk about misogyny. And Lindsay Hoyle, the Speaker of the House, having the temerity to phone the editor of the Mail on Sunday to demand a meeting with him because of a story in yesterday's paper, a silly story, a throwaway story, claiming that Angela Rayner was using her legs to distract the Prime Minister. Misogyny, hate crimes, all that sort of stuff. What do you think, T?
I think propaganda. Propaganda. So this is a complete and utter nonsense story from start to finish. The idea is it just takes up airtime, airwaves, call them inches, and it gets people thinking about the manipulation of the women by men, abuse of men by women, how different women and men are. Look, we are 95%, shall we say, the same. No, you know, that is not really hardly mentioned. So this is a divide and rule tactic. It's also a tactic to swamp the airwaves with nonsense to keep out the truth. You know, the idea that this is a story, I think, is even, you know, well, it doesn't really meet the first criteria. What you're doing is you're talking about something which may not have even happened.
Yes, good point, and we should leave it there. But just 30 seconds more.
You've been sucked in.
I've been sucked in, yeah. Because I think you're absolutely, everything you said there is right. There isn't a but here. I think they'll use it, though, for certain agendas, namely, obviously, censorship, namely, you know, imposing self-censorship on people, getting people terrified about doing anything, lest they be called out. So you're right, it is absolute nonsense in light of what else is going on, but it's a niggly little one. And, you know, when you have the Speaker of the House phoning up the editor of the Mail on Sunday to say, you should be careful about how you talk about women and stuff like that, that's sinister, that.
Well, what when they phone up the editor of the Mail on Sunday and say and ask him what Tony Blair, as Tony Blair did, and say, well, what did David Shaler and Annie Machon tell you about me? This is really an important conversation that they've had with the editor of the Mail on Sunday. And of course, the nowadays, as we've seen over in France, the politicians really just rely on the newspapers, the press, to get in. They are absolutely scared of the press. I mean, as we've seen all the stuff with Harry, etc. He's scared. Very scared, should we say, with the press. The press is, you know, is attempting to lead opinion as it shouldn't really be ever doing. Of course, you can have a leader column, you can have opinion pieces in the press, but the idea is now that the people who own the press are basically in lockstep. You've got the Associated Press Newswire, which is basically most of the stuff we see in our newspapers here comes straight from there. Owned by Reuters as well. So you've got these newswire services, which are basically, they were put together, and they are, their main function is just churning out stock figures, stock price figures. These are now being used to write almost all of our news, Richie. And I you know, it does my head in to think that you have to phone the editor of the Mail on Sunday about something so trivial. Much more interesting to find out, did David Shaler and Annie Machon see Tony Blair's MI5 file when he was there? Because he was working for them. He was doing all sorts of things. He was infiltrating groups like CND for MI5. And that's a real conversation to have about the interaction between the people we elect and the security state. That's a real conversation.
It is. I'd like to pick that up again with you in the future. It's quite a time since I got into that. And I like to refresh our listeners' memories on things like that from time to time. Now, before we do talk about China, I've got to talk about France, the incumbent one, Emmanuel Macron. I think he's the first incumbent to defend, to hold on to his office and get a second term in 20 years or thereabouts. Does it matter, Tony, really, who leads France?
Of course
France?
It matters. It matters incredibly that whether or not the French people get somebody, you know, to represent them as a president who is actually representing the people rather than, I mean, one of the main problems, of course, was that Marine Le Pen has failed in the past. So why is she there again? You know, if you failed, then I'm afraid you've just got to make way for someone else to do your job. Now, you know, she's also got these links back through her family to the Pétain, Marshal Pétain, and the German occupation of France in the Second World War, which is really not a good thing. That proved to be her undoing, I think, back in 2017. She should have stood aside. I mean, she had some actually really fantastic policies which would have beaten Macron. One of which, I mean, I interviewed Eric Simon on my program for Friday, and there's a longer interview up with me. People want to hear what's really going on. He's attended a lot of these yellow vest protests over the years, and he's a Anglophile French guy. He's worked over in London a lot as well, and he was saying the main issues are basically things like the EU. We need to have somebody who's going to get us out of the EU, who's not, you know, linked to the Nazis, as Le Pen is. And I think she'll just have to get out of the way now. So the idea being that you have she was bringing in this thing, which is a constitutional referendum, like they have in Switzerland. So the constitutional referendum in France, if she'd have got in, she would have implemented that. If also she had won in the forthcoming MP elections, their parliamentary elections that come in a couple of months' time, which would have meant that, you know, she did something brilliant here, which is saying, look, the political class is so controlled, absolutely controlled. Anyone that gets anywhere near power who's working for the people gets character assassinated or shot, bumped off, or some terrible accident happens to them, they have a heart attack, keel over like John Smith or whatever. So what she's saying is, let's any petition which gets 500,000 signatures, and this was something that came from the Yellow Vest, right, is then put out to a referendum, and it's legally binding. So as the country votes for it, the government have to implement it. Now, this is a fantastic transformation in France, would make it a real true people's republic, and yet the people voted for Macron. Now, I think it's feasible that there was vote rigging. I'm not sure, but I just think that, you know, it was stupid to put her forward. There's another thing which she brought in as well, or which she would have done, which is almost certainly to have left the EU, because the French back in, I think it was 2002, wasn't it, Richie? You might be able to remember this as well, the Lisbon Treaty. The French actually voted against the constitution. I think it was something like 55% against, 45% for it. So
yeah, and what happened?
To join the EU,
and
they just
our
didn't
listeners.
Bother to do it.
No, that's
they ignored
right.
The referendum result. You know, so
it,
the
yeah.
French people know this. They're really annoyed about this. So that would almost certainly have meant, if Le Pen had gone in, that they left the EU.
Well,
so,
the Irish voted against the Lisbon Treaty, and you know what they said? They said, you can go back and vote again and vote the way we want you to vote. So we had another one, another referendum. I don't think necessary. I'm not sure it would have mattered. Why are you so convinced? You, of all people, who you know the score. Why would you believe Marine Le Pen?
Well, I just think that she's got nothing to lose. I mean, they are a nationalist party. Farage is much wiser than her, in that he managed to have a very, very strict disciplinary procedure around anyone from the far right joining. I don't think they've quite managed to do that over with the Front National in France. I mean, also, you know, changing the name from the National Front, that was a good start as well. You don't want to have a nationalist party which is calling itself the National Front. You know, it's just it's got all the baggage of the genuine far-right nastiness from years gone by. So you need to have something which is, you know, is not globalist and is, you know, this is the idea is to sort of push the idea of the nation state and not the European Union.
But don't you think that Marine Le Pen and people like her are classic examples of controlled opposition? I'm not saying that's true. I'm asking you, I don't know if that's true, but do you consider that to be a possibility?
Well, of course, there's always control. And the control, I think, in the Front National was, basically buttering her up narcissistically, convincing her that she was the best person to lead the Nationalist Party in France into the next presidential election. She should have stood aside, Richie, simple as that. Let someone else, younger, not tainted with this sort of bloodline link down to the Nazis, which she is, let France move on. But, she should have stood aside. She didn't. She could have been there to advise and help, maybe take part in as a presidential advisor or something if Front National had won. But anyway, it's just going to be the same old nonsense. A Rothschild banker, he was very close to them, as Macron is now still in charge, smug, And actually, it's amazing that he's got away with it after the horrific measures they've had in France, particularly over COVID and the absolute merciless crushing of anybody talking about using ivermectin and chloroquine, which happened over there. Yeah, they actually took all the chloroquine out of the shops in January before most people ever even knew that it could potentially save your life.
Here's a guy who said he wanted to make life very uncomfortable for the unvaccinated. I think he said he wanted to piss them off. That was the exact quote. I think word for word in French, obviously, he wanted to piss off the unvaccinated until they gave in and had a jab. Yeah, it's been horrific in France. There's no doubt about that. Tony Gosling is our guest. Well, the French have got him for 5 years. What's going on in China, particularly in Shanghai and Beijing, is unimaginable, really. I mean, it really is. It's the stuff of the darkest, most dystopian science fiction novels. And I look at it and I keep asking myself the question, Tony, could that happen here? Could it happen at some stage here? What's happening to the Chinese? This thing where you're told, you have to test. If you don't take a test, somebody will come and take you away and escort you to a testing center. If you test positive, we're going to put you into a quarantine center. They're separating children from adults, from their parents. The food crisis there, people throwing themselves off of buildings because life is so unbearable. It's actually hard to imagine this is going on. And yet I know it is. What are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, your most poignant of all your little questions there was, could it happen here? And of course, it could happen here. I mean, I think the idea is what seems to be going on in China right now is they're trialing a system, and they're trialing methods of control of the population. I had a guy called Kees van der Peel who's written a couple of books. His book Pandemic of Angst is really good. I think I spoke to you about it last time. Yeah. It's the idea here is that as the fascists try and take over the world, and of course I'm talking here really about authoritarian communists as well as authoritarian capitalists, maybe anarcho-capitalists, people that just don't really believe in the rule of law. They just believe in, the strength, the law of the jungle, basically, the survival of the fittest. That's their only real law, like Aleister Crowley, funnily enough. And those people are just trying out various methods around the world. China is an easy place to do this because it's an incredibly authoritarian government, and I don't know why, if there were satire programs, they would have been doing this, wouldn't they, for the last couple of years or so. Xi, who must be obeyed, some sort of transgender President Xi, if I'm allowed to say that, in the image of the old Hammer film, so they are just trialing these stuff over there, Richie. I'm quite convinced of that. They're seeing what can we get away with, what will what will convince people, what will not convince people, and they do intend to bring that sort of stuff over here. My colleague Martin Summers, I do a weekly program with.
Yes.
He thinks that the Chinese Communist Party and the West are not really working together. I'm convinced they are, through figures like Kissinger. And Anthony Sutton also in his work, which was Wall Street, The Rise of Hitler, Wall Street, The Bolshevik Revolution, it all convinces me that there's been a hidden hand behind the scenes with the Freemasons in the US and with the Tongs in China, basically the same organization. So, I think that's much more likely to be what's going on there, Richie, is that you've got people who are trialing these systems in countries where they can get away with it. In China, they can do pretty much whatever they want because it's a very authoritarian. People are just obedient. Just one little anecdote of the Chinese. I had a lovely friend who's an Indian, and she had a whole load of students over from China. And they just don't kind of think for themselves. So they're basically waiting to be told what to have for breakfast. And they're coming down in the morning, and we have to wait for such and such to come down. He will tell us what we have for breakfast. You know, this kind of attitude is just not a Western attitude. You know, it's like Fu Manchu, you know. Well, I don't know if you remember the Fu Manchu novels, but I just happen to have a little quote here from Fu Manchu. He says, my power rests in the East, but my hand is stretched out to the West. I shall restore the lost grandeur of China when your civilization, as you're pleased to term it, has exterminated itself. When you've reduced to ashes your palaces and your temples, you've set back the clock which is so laboriously you fashioned. I shall stir our fallen. The golden dawn of the East will come. You know, so this has been around for a long time, this whole idea that actually it's the ruthlessness of the and the inscrutability of the Chinese which will dominate eventually. And I think there are quite a lot of people in China that say that just believe if we do what we're told, we can rule the world, we can take over, and it will, you know. But of course there's a whole, you know, possibly a majority even in China that are just simply not happy with this, and they just simply don't know how to.
But they don't know how to. This is it. That was my next question. You've partly answered it. Why is there so little opposition? I mean, the idea that men, and you know, it broke my heart.
You don't get to hear about it, Richie. Even if there is large amounts of opposition, it will not be allowed to.
That's a point as well.
I'm afraid they really are very, very strict in keeping an absolute lockdown on their internet, on their newspapers, any kind of, you know, and that sort of stuff. Any dissent. I mean, I don't know if you remember, but there was a big demo in Wuhan just before all the in 2019. It was about an incinerator, and loads of people were locked up as a result of it. You know, they don't take lightly people coming doing protests over there. And also, of course, they're very, 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 very strict about what the rest of the world sees about what goes on in China.
Yeah, that's true enough. Yeah, on my behalf, it's a bit naive wondering why they don't attempt to do anything about it, imagining that we would hear about it. That's a good point, Tony. Tony Gosling is our guest, not to the BCFM Politics Show, Fridays at 5 o'clock, thisweek.org.uk, bilderberg.org. Check out Tony's books. You've done some brilliant work, pal, lately, well, for a long time, but lately, on how the mass media is driving, is pushing and pushing and pushing for things to escalate in Eastern Europe. I said to you, maybe I said it to somebody else, but there's this feeling of a real stalemate there now, right now, that things are just going to pretty much stay as they are for some time to come, maybe even months. And I wonder, what will that mean? Why would it, you know, just kind of quagmire now for months? And who would that suit? And is there anything that could happen that would escalate it?
Well, you remember Afghanistan, because that was a quagmire for the Russians
years and
too.
Years, yeah.
You know, the idea was to draw them in and bog them down, and you know, tie them up, and then you know, destroy their morale. I think a lot of this is about morale, particularly the sinking of the Russian ship the other day. You know, the Moskva. The idea is to send an Easter message to the world that, oh dear, the Russian flagship sunk. Oh, what a shame. And of course, you know, the role of NATO in these things is very questionable. It may even be, Richie, that NATO are doing some of these missile strikes inside Russia, that it is actual NATO munitions rather than Ukrainian. It's not impossible that they may be just seeing what can we get away with here, knowing that the Russians don't want to, give away their knowledge that NATO has helped, as they almost certainly did with the sinking of this big ship, the guided missile cruiser. And, you know, so, yeah, but I think the Russians actually want to fight in a way, but they don't want to. Maybe that it's difficult to know what their game is. And, of course, this is partly because this is their tactic, is that they don't want the West to actually figure out what they're really up to. Every now and again, of course, as happened at the beginning of last week, they just completely change what they're doing. Loads of troops move around, they go somewhere completely different. And when I had Scott Ritter on the programme on Friday, he's talking about, well, this is a massive feint. You know, so it's tying up troops, Ukrainian troops, that for something that was never going to happen. and so they could encircle the troops over in the east. And what I want to know is all these tanks they're talking about, you know, various weapons that apparently that we're donating, you know, even though we've got all these homeless people on the streets, you know, etc., and not enough money to keep public toilets open, all this stuff we're donating in tanks and everything, how is it going to get to this army over in the east of Ukraine?
Very good question.
Encircled. It's not. It can't possibly get there. So this is one of the things we looked at in our discussion. On our discussion on Friday, Martin and I pulled apart this BBC program, Where's the Line? Their program had, it was billed as a debate, but it wasn't a debate. It was just a load of anti-Russian people, a couple of military, one from Chatham House, ha-ha. I mean, I don't know if your listeners know about Chatham House. This is set up with money from Cecil Rhodes' will, originally the Round Table Groups, and they set up the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States and the Royal Institute for International Affairs, or Chatham House in London. Even when I was at the BBC, anything big that happened, like the first Gulf War, my producer said, someone from Chatham House, get someone from Chatham House. I'm thinking, well, who are these people? I know who they are. I didn't at the time. I was suspicious at the time, but they are effectively a secret, private secret society that Cecil Rhodes set up with the original object back in 1900 or so, when Rhodes died, was to take over the world, because the British Empire had been doing quite well in taking over lots of places, but they thought, as a secret society, we can take the world over. And that is what you're getting when you get Chatham House. I had some Ukrainian woman from there almost crying. You know, I thought, well, look, this isn't a serious debate discussion program at all. So Martin and I just pulled it to pieces, and you know, with a bit of reality, harsh reality, about what is really going on over there. And you know, it's very difficult to know whether it's going to really be long drawn out, or whether the Russians eventually are just going to take the Donbass and leave it at that.
By the way,
they might do that.
The Chatham House stuff you talked about, the round table groups, the Council on Foreign Relations, Haas, and all of those people, it's excellent. For people who are new to this program, you found it because of the COVID nonsense. If you want to know where the politicians of the world's governments get their instructions, you need to follow that line of inquiry that Tony Gosling was just talking about there. It's hugely important. It's the reason why I sometimes use throwaway lines on this program, that Johnson and his ilk are just front men and women for an agenda. It's not their policies. It isn't their policy. It isn't their idea. It's given to them from somewhere else. Read bilderberg.org, Tony Gosling. Get on that website and start going there. Down that rabbit hole. Now, here's my point. Can I just put a point?
Also, I'd say see the film They Live.
Oh, They Live, yeah.
You see They Live with an exclamation mark after They Live. It is, you know, it's almost about the Council on Foreign Relations, only it's not. And it's brilliant because they portray the people who are part of these secret societies as aliens.
That's right. It's a brilliant film. John Carpenter, isn't it? Rowdy Roddy Piper in the starring role. So without any evidence, just gut feeling, and not because I want this to be true, I don't do that. It's because I can't figure it out any other way. People are dying in Ukraine. Russian soldiers have died. This is a very real thing. However, I think it's one big, massive soap opera. How far into it Putin is, I don't understand, but I believe it's all being done deliberately to cause the food problems and the cost of living crises that we're seeing across Europe now. I really do believe that, Tony. I can't prove it, but the whole thing, it makes no sense to me that Russia would do it now, and I don't buy it. And until somebody proves me wrong.
Well, it does make sense that Russia would do it now. It makes a hell of a lot of sense because they've reacted to the Ukrainian army massing on the border about to invade the Donbass region, Luhansk and Donetsk. That's what they were about to do. And the Russians have leaked the documents that they managed to filch through their signals intelligence, that Ukrainian army was about to attack Donbass. And that's why they did it when they did. And also there were votes, various votes at end of January and early February in the Duma saying that we must go to the defence of these people. Now, remember, there's 15,000 people being killed there since the coup over the last 8 years.
That's right.
So I'm afraid I don't buy this whole thing of, you know, I think what's happened is they have, that NATO have deliberately forced their hand, you know, so it, you know, the timing is a NATO thing. And of course, this is, you know, think about Afghanistan. They brought all those troops back. Why did they do that? Well, maybe they were preparing something else because they knew that if they were left in Afghanistan, they'd just be encircled if there was a wider war. And they're now in a position where they can start to potentially provoke a wider war, and those troops won't be surrounded by the Russians and or the Chinese, you know, down in Afghanistan. They're back home again. So that, I mean, the Great Reset, obviously, this is it. You know, this is what's this is what the Great Reset will be. But it's not.
Allow me to retort. Hang on. Allow me to retort. No, no. Look, everything you said there about the documents, the Russians discovering the documents, the talk and the Duma, the Ukrainians, all of that is true. I don't dispute any of that. And that's why I said I can't prove my theory. But you saying that the documents, that all the evidence is there, that this was going to happen, the Russians had to react, that doesn't mean that that isn't part of the stitch-up. That it's all laid out there for the world to see so that we believe it, so that we believe the Russians were provoked into acting and the Russians were only doing what's right for them. I want to say this, really important, because I've been critical of other independent content creators for going down crazy rabbit holes and saying, you know, the earth is flat and all sorts of stuff like that. And maybe it is. I don't believe it is. But, you know, each to their own. I don't jump to conclusions like that. I believe if they want to make it look perfectly, to make it look, you know, lock stock, that the Russians were provoked into it, here's the evidence, the Russians did it, it's easy for them to do that. None of this makes sense right now to me. It doesn't. Because everything that's happening serves this agenda you just called the Great Reset. Everything, it serves it. It's a gift to this agenda.
But all I'm saying is that the NATO provoked the Russians finally to do this, and they've been sitting there waiting to do it for the last 8 years. They, you know, there's a lot of political pressure in Russia on Putin to save the lives of the Russian ethnic Russians in that part of the world. So I think that, you know, it's basically the chess moves are being made by the NATO countries and the Bilderbergers. You know, those are the people that are actually making those chess moves, and the Russians are reacting to it. Now, I think in a way the Russians are being played in a way like we are being played. But the thing is that they have a far, far you know, more sophisticated backup system, don't they, than we do. You know, they have had many years of threats from the West, and they've, you know, they've got the raw materials, they've got the food, etc., to make sure their people are fed. In fact, I was looking at the, you know, the preparations for nuclear war are quite advanced in China and Russia. They're ready for an attack on them. They're not wanting these things. I think it's the West that's leading all of this, actually. It's the financial elite, you know, the globalists based here, the skull and bonesers, that lot, that, you know, the oligarchy, if you want to call them that, the... They are the ones, the Bilderbergers.
But the Chinese are brutalizing their own people, and they always have done, and they're doing it now. And yet we imagine that in the great battle of good versus evil, the East is not as bad as the West. I don't buy that. I want to reiterate something I said to you, not last time you were on, but the previous time. The Putin administration did nothing to stand in the way of this Great Reset thing. It's done nothing to stand in the way of the great COVID lie. Now, I believe COVID existed, but the vaccines, the Russians were no resistance whatsoever to that agenda. They went along with it.
I'll answer it in a similar way. I mean, since then, we've had the gold-backed ruble now, haven't we? I mean, which is definitely not Great Reset material. This is actually saying, well, our existing currencies are fine. We don't need to change anything.
Yeah.
You know, but the fact of the matter is that the Russians, I think the Russians have had their own independent policies, and we've got this very different. China and Russia, of course, extremely different. They've gone along with the COVID stuff. I think they're buying time. You know, maybe they believed in it, maybe they didn't. Maybe they just thought we can cut a deal with the West here, but they've realised that they can't eventually, and they're now in a position, as we've seen this new, is it Sarmat missile that he tested last week? They're now in a position. They've developed the technology to fight and win. They believe. potentially anyway, if anyone would win a nuclear war. And they're now able to stand up to the Americans. Whatever the Americans do, they can say, no, we're not doing that. When there's very, very few people around the world that can do that. But China, I think, is it's like the States. It's controlled by the secret societies from above. But hang on, the whole point is to get China and America fighting each other in a third world war. Russia is not necessarily going to be, well, it may be on the Chinese side, but it is, I think, still reasonably independent as a nation. And I think they have the confidence because they've got some depth in their democracy over there. You know, the stuff Putin is doing is what the Russian people want overall. He's got something like 80% approval rating now.
Yeah, according to him. How do we know that? It's funny you say that he's got 80% approval rating. Why should we believe that?
He's got a depth in the... So if Putin is bumped off and whoever replaces him is bumped off, there are loads of people in the political class and in the military over in Russia who have a similar mind, you know, who are fairly flexible, and you know they're there to serve the people rather than just to feather their own nest, as our lot are.
I'm not sure I agree with that. Putin is a multi-millionaire. He's a gangster. I could talk Sochi Olympics. I've no time for him. But look, I'm giving you the final word on that. But I wanted to ask you something else. We've really only got 3 minutes, and I thought of you earlier. Last week, I was listening to Times Radio, God help me, for a few minutes. And who was on there speaking to John Pienaar? Only Jeremy Corbyn. And if I could have throttled Corbyn on the spot, I'd have throttled him on the spot. This useless goon, Jeremy Corbyn. He was talking about NATO and disbanding NATO. I do not matter as a person. I'm just a content creator like you. But when Corbyn was elected as Labour leader, I called it exactly what would happen. I said he was useless. I said he would do and say nothing. He would certainly say nothing that he had been saying at protest marches and meetings for years. I turned out to be right. To hear Corbyn mumbling on Times Radio about NATO and expanding NATO and making a case, you know, for not so much making a case for Russia, but saying that it's a bit more nuanced and blah, blah, blah. I thought, you yellow bastard, in 3.5, 4 years as Labour leader, in live television interviews, you said nothing about anything. What a dreadful, wretched man Corbyn is. And well, I think look, proof...
He's a nice guy, but he wasn't anywhere near capable of being leader. Look, did he say that Paul Hauser, who was an SS general at the end of the Second World War, I wonder if Corbyn said this, that NATO, it's a quote from Hauser, that NATO was created out of some of the units of the SS. Did Corbyn quote that, for example?
No,
that would
of course
be quite
not.
Interesting thing to throw at Pienaar, wouldn't it? He doesn't really have the depth, I don't think, of knowledge, Corbyn, to do it. But he was a nice guy. He was basically trying to play kumbaya, but he wasn't really up to the top job of being a politician, I'm afraid. But, you know, very good at doing speeches. He's been on the right side of history, I think, through the Irish Troubles, etc. And, you know, what's the problem? It's just that he was put in a position which he wasn't up to the job. And, he flaked out on Brexit.
He flaked out on
the anti-Semitism business. He should have got that sorted out right originally. And then he started helping the people who are after his blood, you know, rather than the people who are his allies.
He had no courage.
But, you know, it's easy to say these. I mean, I've had a very kind of privileged, and I really do understand, I've had a very privileged life. And, you know, being, for example, you know, working for the Beeb in the late 80s, early 90s, working with people like Chris Morris, the comedian, God knows what happened to him, but he was an absolutely brilliant, brilliant comedian. He would, if he had a chance now, would be ripping into these imbeciles thinking that they're running the show, that actually are trying to, you know, what did you see this thing today? Oh, artificial embryos. Why do we need women's,
I did see this in the Times. You know, I did see this, yeah.
This stuff should be completely, I mean, who is going to do the research into this? Who's going to allow someone to grow babies?
Grow a baby, yeah.
Test tube, you know? So, working with people like Johnny Walker, Tommy Vance, working alongside Liz McKean in Southampton, the woman that exposed the Jimmy Savile scandal, and we're very privileged when it comes to information. Corbyn, I'm afraid, you know, he just didn't realise what he was up against. I have absolutely nothing against the guy at all, because he was very well-intentioned. And I think that is a starting point with all politics. People have got to be well-intentioned. Even if they're not up to the job, at least give it a go.
That's the last word on Corbyn. I'm a man of my word. Briefly, if you can, is it too early to ask who's on the programme this coming Friday? It's an excellent radio programme, folks. It really is. It stands alone, really. It's terrific. Any idea who's on Friday,
T? It's not. I've got one interview in the bag for Friday, which is about Nazi ecology, which is quite interesting. It's the whole Nazi approach to the environmental movement, which... You know, it's pretty chilling, actually, the idea that, you know, you can go from an organization that wants to, like, you know, squatters' rights, you know, like we need to share out the land is a nice, good idea. That's quite a nice thing. But it can get very, very nasty right the way down to eugenics. And I've got one of the world experts, Mark Musser, he's written the book on Nazi ecology, talking about that, because I think it's really important to understand what the Extinction Rebellion lot are up to. They are not, to my mind, proper ecologists or environmentalists at all. They're people who are just sort of bought and paid for, and their leadership is very questionable. The idea really is to, you know, go along with this great reset, to commit harry-carry when it comes to...
Absolutely, and a lot of scared children. A lot of scared children.
Personally, it's a terrible thing to say. I'm a big fan of coal. We've got hundreds of years of coal in South Wales. Let's dig it out, and let's if we haven't got
people back to work,
let's dig out some of those old steam trains, and we can maybe run a railway on coal.
See, that's utopia. Team, we're right out of time, folks. Go to thisweek.org.uk. Check out bilderberg.org. Buy a Tony Gosling book. Support the independent media. 5 o'clock Fridays, live out of Bristol, not the BCFM politics show. Brilliant to have you back, T. Thanks for your time again, mate. Love having you on.
Thanks, Richie. Cheers. Bye.
And speak again real soon. Tony Gosling, live on Monday's Richie Allen Show.